Why does Scott Turow, master of the legal thriller, so love the law?
For me, what has always just absolutely seized me by the heart is the questions of what kind of behavior can a community tolerate and what does it have to prohibit for the well-being of everybody. That's really often comes down to a question of good and evil. So that's number one. Number two is, how do you make rules that are efficient, that are wise in their application, and, you know, that work out well in practice? So to me, those fundamental questions, both how the legal process is supposed to work and how social conduct is supposed to be governed, that is the, you know, bottom line on the law. And as Sandy Stern, the hero of The Last Trial, likes to think of this, he sees the goal of the law as to make life in the few areas that human beings can actually control a little more reasonable.
We spend most of the hour with Turow talking not only about the fictional case in The Last Trial, but also about some very real cases going on right now. And later, we hear from a former Writer's Voice guest, the poet Catherine Levy, who was involved in a just-decided legal case with critical implications for the 2020 election. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer, Francesca Rhiannon. I confess that until I had the chance to read Scott Turow's latest novel, I'd never read one of his books. Oversight, probably, along with the fear that a lengthy trial on paper would be boring. Boy, was I wrong. Turow has a gift for exploring the meticulous details of the law in a way that's utterly spellbinding, and he matches that with a deep examination of the twisty and twisted pathways of the human heart and its motivations. That's what I discovered in reading The Last Trial. Its protagonist is octogenarian Sandy Stern, defense lawyer extraordinaire, who's decided he'll bring the curtain down on his legal career at the conclusion of what appears to be an unwinnable final case. A challenge, for sure. It involves a supremely narcissistic defendant, a world-famous cancer doctor accused of murder, insider trading, and fraud. He's also Sandy Stern's doctor and one of his best friends. The Washington Post Review said of Scott Turow and The Last Trial, "No one has illuminated the human side of the legal profession with such precision and care. The Last Trial is Scott Turow at his best and most ambitious." Scott Turow is the author of 10 novels, including Presumed Innocent and The Burden of Proof, and 3 works of nonfiction. Well, Scott Turow, it is such a pleasure to welcome you to Writer's Voice.
It's great to be here with you, Francesca. Thanks for having me on.
So this book, The Last Trial, which I hugely enjoyed, is your 11th book, your 9th novel, all centered on courtroom dramas. You were an attorney yourself, in fact, an assistant U.S. attorney in Chicago, and served there until 1986. Then you devoted your life to writing courtroom dramas. You must love the law. Why?
Well, my attraction to the law came as a surprise to me as an adult. At that stage in my life, I was a young lecturer in the English department at Stanford, having been a writing fellow there. And I was headed toward an academic career and not all that happy about the prospect, only because, you know, I didn't have what it took to be a teacher. And I began asking myself, if not that, then what? And, you know, there were several possibilities. Advertising, I could have gone to Hollywood. My ex-wife had a relative who probably would have hired me for a studio job. But the only thing I saw that I thought was really great and interesting were my friends involved in criminal law, either as prosecutors or defense lawyers. And I began to contemplate going to law school. And the cost of that would be that, you know, everybody told me I'd never be able to continue my, you know, long aspired to career as a would-be novelist. But I eventually decided, don't let other people's expectations set your own. And I said, I'd go to law school and I'd try to keep writing. And I ended up with a contract to write a book about my experiences as a law student, even before I'd gotten to law school. But the book came out in my last year as a law student, 1L, still in print. It was, by the standards of first books, extremely successful. But I, along the way, had realized that I really had taken my own measure well, and that I really was as fascinated by the law and the questions it asks as I thought I would be. And that was a great surprise to me. My father had hated lawyers. I had no idea really what lawyers did, you know, and except for the people that I'd seen in court, I still didn't know that. I remember, you know, the law is, as taught in law school, is basically the study of judges' decisions. That's how the law in the U.S. in many areas evolves, which is from case to case. This is the matter of precedent. And it's called the common law, meaning judge-made law. And I'm in my first week in law school, I was already there, and I turned to the guy next to me in my, I think it was my civil procedure class, guy named Rick Stryker, who I'm still friendly with. And I looked at him and I said, Strike, you know, what the hell is the common law? So I knew nothing about what I was getting into. I just knew that I was fascinated by the fundamental questions. And despite the success of 1L, I decided that I would practice.
Yeah, so I do want to move on to this wonderful book. And I have to say, you said you didn't think you had it in you to be a teacher, but I learned so much from this book, The Last Trial. But I can't but ask you to at least briefly tell us what you see as the fundamental questions of the law.
Well, for me, what has always just absolutely seized me by the heart is the questions of what kind of behavior can a community tolerate and what does it have to prohibit for the well-being of everybody. That's really often comes down to a question of good and evil, especially when you're talking about the criminal law. So that's number one. Number two is, how do you make rules either to govern that behavior or to guide the procedure by which lawyers are going to do their business? How do you make rules that are efficient, that are wise in their application, and, you know, that work out well in practice? So to me, those fundamental questions, both how the legal process is supposed to work and how social conduct is supposed to be governed, that is the, you know, bottom line on the law. And as Sandy Stern, the hero of The Last Trial, likes to think of this, he sees the goal of the law as to make life in the few areas that human beings can actually control a little more reasonable. That's how he puts it to himself.
And this is really, the whole book is an example of that, because it doesn't necessarily judge somebody on whether they do bad things, but on what it lines the boundaries of what can be ruled on for society versus what part of those bad things need to be just left up to the character themselves.
Right. I mean, when you're talking about the criminal law, there's a judgment in a democracy that, although people never think about it this way, the criminal law exists not just to punish, on one hand, which it certainly does, but on the other, to make sure that the government cannot imprison people willy-nilly and just, you know, get rid of the people who are difficult for one reason or another. Instead, you can only take somebody's liberty away from them if the government can prove beyond a reasonable doubt that they did something wrong. If it's uncertain, if we just don't know whether they did it or not, then anybody who's a criminal defendant gets to walk out of the courtroom and go on with their lives. And, you know, those are not concepts that lay people are particularly comfortable with. And they're always asking criminal defense lawyers, how can you defend somebody like that? To which the answer is, it's my job and it's why I chose to do this. So you're talking about what really preoccupies me at the center of being a lawyer. And, you know, these indeed are the kinds of questions.
And of course, I think what you're talking about is the ideal because, you know, where the laws are not just, for example, the United States imprisons something like a quarter of the entire world's,
Right.
In mass incarceration is a real problem. You have laws that are not just. We've always had laws that are not just. And so that doesn't apply. So how do you resolve that kind of the tension between the ideal of the law as impartial, as reason, versus being infected by the prejudices of its time?
Well, I personally, when I decided to go on practicing law after the success of Presumed Innocent, said I was going to do what the young man who went to law school wanted me to do, which is, you know, to have my own little bitty tiny role in making the world a little more just. And that, to me, meant spending a considerable part of my time providing legal services to poor people, and generally in criminal cases, and, you know, doing what I can. And that's also, you know, representing the poor is a complex business because it's sometimes the case that your clients haven't done what the police think they did. And more often it's the case that they have. But going back to what we were talking about before, that our system operates on the premise that you can't take away somebody's liberty unless the government has a huge mass of evidence sufficient to prove them guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, there can be a big difference between what happens to a poor person charged with a crime when she or he has a lawyer with the time and the resources to, you know, to go to the mat and push the government to the wall. So that is my, you know, that has been one of my tasks as a lawyer, and I don't judge anybody else for not spending as much of their time doing that because, very frankly, I've been really lucky that, you know, writing novels has supported me and my family. But, you know, I'm ever mindful of it. And, of course, Sandy Stern in The Last Trial as a criminal defense lawyer is also mindful of it. And one of the things he points to, and it really makes the point, Francesca, that you were starting to make, is he compares the insider trading laws. His client, Stern's client in The Last Trial, is charged with insider trading. And, you know, Stern points out what the difference is between what happens with somebody who trades on inside information versus somebody who's stolen a treasury check from the mail. They've both taken possession of something that doesn't naturally belong to them, but the insider trading laws favor the rich and erect all kinds of obstacles to conviction, whereas if somebody steals a Social Security check out of the mail, there is a presumption that that even though they're only caught with the check, there's a presumption that they know that they've got stolen property in their hands. And, you know, that contrast between the law that gets applied to the rich and the law that gets applied to the poor is very much on Stern's mind as somebody who came to the United States as what we would now call, you know, an undocumented or an illegal immigrant. And he has come to affluence and success from a life that began in poverty. And so he never loses track of the contrast in the way the law operates for the rich and for the poor.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Scott Turow about his latest legal thriller, The Last Trial, featuring protagonist Sandy Stern, a character that's appeared in several of his novels. And he's a wonderful character. He's been a character in previous novels. I saw that he's based on a real person.
No, his Stern's physical being is something that I borrowed from a friend of my parents who was a Cuban immigrant. And he looked just like Stern looks. In other words, he was relatively short, bald-headed, a little round, never, despite having come to the U.S. at an early age, never quite got rid of his accent. But he was such a polished and urbane figure that there was just a kind of charisma that emanated from him. He was not a lawyer. And as I said, I borrowed his figure and his manner for Sandy Stern when I suddenly found myself dreaming of a defense lawyer in the middle of the writing of Presumed Innocent. And, you know, once I'd done that, if you're lucky and a book is going well, there is always a character who, as I like to put it, runs away with the book. And in this novel, in The Last Trial, it's Stern's granddaughter, is very idiosyncratic paralegal called Pinky. But, you know, Stern was that person in the writing of Presumed Innocent. He became the central figure in my second novel, The Burden of Proof. And as you point out, he's appeared usually in the background in every novel since. And I am full of affection for him, and but he comes, he really was largely made up out of whole cloth. Interestingly, you know, there have always been a couple of defense lawyers in Chicago who claimed they were the model for Sandy Stern, and I've never wanted to disabuse them. Or now, you know, their kids, now that they've passed away, of that idea. And there's, you know, moderate truth to it. But generally speaking, Stern was sort of my conception of what a really great defense lawyer would be. And you have to bear in mind that I came to that idea while I was writing Presumed Innocent, and I had never been a defense lawyer. When I finished that book, I finished it when I left the prosecutor's office and wrote most of it on the morning commuter trains on my way to work as a federal prosecutor. So I can say in all honesty that Stern is not actually based on anybody.
He's a wonderful character. And you know, the fact that he is toward the end of his life, I think makes the character richer because he has a whole life to look back on. And the other characters, too, who are all seen through his eyes, are really are very complex, and there are complex relationships between them. So tell us about Carol Pafko, who is the defendant, a flawed defendant, to say the least.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the things Stern accepts is that, generally speaking, as a criminal defense lawyer, as he says, it's not likely to improve your opinion of anybody. Carol is Stern's. Is Stern's friend of 40 years. He's 78 years old now himself and has had a life that by outward measure is even more distinguished than Stern's has been. He's a former winner of the Nobel Prize in medicine. And significantly, you know, Stern made his last major appearance in my novels in a book called Innocent, which was a sequel to Presumed Innocent I wrote 20 years later. And at that point, Stern for reasons I can't really explain, had been ravaged by advanced lung cancer. And readers wrote and said, you know, gee, we love Sandy Stern. Don't tell us he's dying. And I would say, no, he's not going to die. At which point, of course, I had to figure out how he didn't die. And that meant, at least as I thought about it, that he might have encountered a successful new therapy for his lung cancer. Well, Carol Pafko is the man who created this fictional cancer medication called G-Livia. And as I said, Pafko is a Nobel Prize winner and a prominent cancer researcher. And he's developed this cancer wonder drug. The only problem is that not only does G-Livia save a significant number of lives, it also effectively ends some lives because it causes an allergic reaction. And the government says that Pafko knew that when he applied to get the drug approved, and he didn't disclose that. He didn't tell the government that, hey, there are some very important problems here and that this drug not only saves lives, it also kills people. And so he has been charged by the government with racketeering, with murder, with insider trading, with mail fraud. And he comes to Stern. And he has arranged for Stern to be one of the first humans ever treated with G-Livia. And Stern is in that lucky group whose life has been greatly prolonged. His cancer has been held at bay ever since he started taking the medication. And Pafko says in substance to Stern, I saved your life, now you save mine. And at the age of 85, clearly, you know, with his practice dwindling, he decides that he will take on one last major case, a nationally celebrated criminal trial against, in which the government has charged Kirill Pafko with these felonies, which if proven will mean that he's going to end his life in prison. And Stern says he will, you know, give it all he has to save his friend.
I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and this is Writer's Voice. We're talking with Scott Turow about his latest legal thriller, The Last Trial. It explores how new drugs are approved by the FDA, insider trading, and the contradictory impulses of the human heart. So The Last Trial, actually, you know, for me, reading it became especially topical when it comes to time-consuming FDA requirements for approving G-Livia. This is part of the whole issue here, is how the process of approval for a drug happens, because his failure to adhere to the guidelines, I guess, is the basis for one of the charges.
It is. It's really the fundamental basis, yeah. Because it's the FDA, of course, has rules saying, if you know there's something wrong with this medication, that it causes adverse reactions, then you need to say so before we approve it.
So now we're kind of in an opposite situation where we have an FDA that is, you know, bringing, for example, antibody testing for the COVID-19 virus to market without adequate testing. So talk a little bit about, you know, this concept of, is it, I wrote it down here, but I can't find it, the emergency use of drug, and what you think about what's going on now.
Well, as you say, the novel deals directly with what fast-track approval of medications. And because G-Livia, because it seems to be such a lifesaver, wins approval that way. And in candor, I think the novel illustrates what the risks are of that process. The bottom line is that we, and this is talking about the questions in the law that have always gripped me, we as a society have made a judgment that if there's a medication like the antibody test that will seemingly save lives, it can go on the market as long as it doesn't have a equal and opposite reaction, that it somehow can cost lives. For example, if you've got an antibody test that works 70% of the time, then that means 30% of the people who take that test are going to be under the mistaken impression that they are immune to COVID-19, and they are going to sally forth in their lives without observing all of the precautions that many of us have been following for a couple of months now. So is that the right thing to do? Is that a worthwhile trade in the case of an antibody test? I actually would say not. You don't want 30% of the people who take your test to end up essentially having to risk their lives every day because they're under a mistaken impression that it works. And, you know, the push and pull in drug approval, which is basically to save lives and not let people risk their lives on false information, as I said, is well illustrated in the last trial. And it's also a fascinating kind of conundrum, because there are people out there who would say, well, you know, if a drug may save the lives of two in 10 COVID patients, then who cares what the side effects are? And the answer is, well, you know, if there's critical side effects for 3 in 10 patients, you really shouldn't have that drug on the market. And there's been a lot of thinking over the years about this. There's a set of rules that I think is incredibly complex and arcane at the FDA, in part because the pharmaceutical companies find it to their interest to make life for the FDA complicated so it, you know, it can't interfere with their medications once they're on the market. But at the core, assuming that system worked efficiently, it does work on a set of assumptions that I think everybody with a lot of thought would probably agree with.
And that's very relevant to the other issue that's come up of hydroxychloroquine.
Yes, it is.
Would you like to weigh in on that one as well?
Well, you noticed that the discussion of hydroxychloroquine, which was undergoing a rigorous clinical trial in New York State, has dropped off the screen. And I would presume that the reason that's happened is that the evidence does not support the notion that this is helpful to a large number of COVID-19 patients at any stage of their illness. And this illustrates the danger of making your medication market a kind of Wild West. You know, there are a lot of free marketers like Milton Friedman, for example, who would say, oh, just put it out there and people will experience what they experience. And as long as they get good information, you know, the market will decide whether a medication ought to be used or not. Well, that's not fair because information is not equally distributed. And when you just say, go ahead and use hydroxychloroquine, what do you have to lose? As it turns out, you have a lot to lose because it can take somebody who is going to recover eventually and leave them with heart problems. And so, you know, the fundamental adage of the Hippocratic Oath is to first do no harm. And saying, go take hydroxychloroquine does harm. So, you know, there we go.
And you investigated, as an attorney, district attorney, you investigated corruption. We have a lot of ripe examples of that in the world today. Do you think that the FDA, and of course you don't know, I mean, but I'm just like your opinion. Do you think the FDA is in fact being pressured in what one can call a corrupt manner to give accelerated approval to these drugs or tests because of political reasons as opposed to scientific ones?
Well, I have to say, when you really study what goes on with the FDA, they are always under immense pressure. And because of the way our political system works, you know, the pharmaceutical companies, which make huge amounts of money, are able to afford lobbyists who go to members of Congress who turn around and pressure the FDA and say, you know, don't make this rule approve this drug. So it's nothing new for the FDA to be under political pressure. It's not right, because that's not the way the agency is supposed to function. The kind of political pressure that exists now, where everybody in the society is at risk from this devastating virus, you know, that is unusual. And, you know, in candor, the FDA has a huge number of dedicated professionals, and especially the scientists who work there. But it's not an agency that has ever functioned with tip-top efficiency. And, you know, these kinds of pressures are bound to make the agency even less effective.
Novelist Scott Turow. His new legal thriller is The Last Trial. After the break, we'll talk with him about his recent post in Vanity Fair concerning the Supreme Court's consideration of whether Trump's tax returns can be released, as well as get his opinion of the move by Attorney General William Barr to drop the case against Michael Flynn. Don't go away. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter. It's free at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. And if you're listening to the podcast, rate us on iTunes or whatever podcast app you use. It really helps others to find the show. Today, we're talking with novelist Scott Turow about his latest legal thriller, The Last Trial. In his writing, Turow uses his own deep knowledge about the law. He served as assistant district attorney in Chicago in the 1980s and prosecuted some high-profile cases concerning corruption. In addition to fiction, he also writes essays and op-eds in national publications about current legal issues. I asked him about a recent one. So I wonder if I could ask you about a recent article that you published in Vanity Fair, just kind of on the subject of corruption and the rule of law, which of course is so central to all of your books. This article is titled, "Is Trump Above the Law? The Supreme Court is About to Not Decide." You published this a week before the case was heard. But you say in it that in order to rule for Trump, the justices will have to significantly rewrite existing law. Tell us why.
Well, to try to be concise about a complex legal issue, what we're talking about is a case in which the Congress has issued a number of subpoenas and the Manhattan District Attorney's Office has issued a grand jury subpoena for President Trump's financial records, including his long-concealed tax returns. And under the law, generally speaking, when the records in question are in the hands of third parties, which is what's true in this case, the subpoenas are aimed at Trump's bankers and his accountants, particularly when those records have been made by the bankers and the accountants rather than the subject of the investigation, which would be the president. The law gives a person in the president's position, it gives him no quarter. It says, forget it. You don't have First Amendment rights. You don't have Fourth Amendment rights. You don't have Fifth Amendment rights, because this is a subpoena directed to somebody else. It's not directed to you. And somehow, the Supreme Court in its discussion has chosen largely to blow past that fact and their own body of law that says, knock it off. We don't allow investigation subjects to object to third-party subpoenas. So that's point number one. Point number two is that both Nixon versus the United States and Clinton versus Jones have ruled that a president has to respond to court process. And that's when the subpoena is served on the president directly, which is not what's happening here. And particularly Clinton versus Jones, which said, oh, it's not a big deal. The president can respond to deposition requests and, you know, document requests while he's the sitting president, even though there's the risk that thousands of Americans might sue him while he's in office and he'd have to be burdened with doing that. Clinton versus Jones cannot, with any intellectual honesty, be squared with the idea that Trump doesn't have to answer these subpoenas. And I have to say the justices were on top of that. And so my prediction in the article is that Cyrus Vance, the Manhattan prosecutor, will get the records he is seeking. The Congress, on the other hand, is probably not going to get them. And the fact is that politics is going to infect this. The risk that Trump is running is that his financial records and tax returns will come out before the next election. When Vance gets those records, they're subject to rules of grand jury secrecy. Now, there are ways that those records can be disclosed, and I would suspect as soon as they are delivered to Vance, there are going to be requests for disclosure that go to the courts in New York, but we can depend on President Trump to keep litigating in order to keep those records secret. The Congress, on the other hand, would reveal them immediately, and for that reason, my suspicion is that as part of a compromise within the court to vindicate the principle that no person is above the law, but to insulate Trump from political damage, they will kick back the congressional case and order a lower court to take further steps. And I have to say that I think that's wrong. The argument being made by people like Justice Thomas is, wow, look at all these subpoenas. They're asking for all this information. You know, the president's lawyers are going to have to go over and look at all of this and ask him about it. It's going to take a lot of his time. And that essentially rewards the president for concealing all of these records from the public in a context in which presidential candidates for decades have disclosed them. So it's the only reason it's quote unquote burdensome to the president to be dealing with these subpoenas is because he's chosen to defy public norms. But my prediction remains that in order to cobble together a Supreme Court majority that both supports in general the idea that the Congress can engage in oversight of the president and that prosecutors have the right to go forward in their investigations of a number of people, including the president, the court will try to insulate Mr. Trump from the political fallout of a sweeping decision in favor of Congress and the prosecutors.
Now, Congress is co-equal to the executive power, and doesn't this put an undue burden on the oversight responsibility of Congress? I mean, how can they investigate anything if they can't get records?
Well, their argument, the Trump argument, by the way, is one that talks out of both sides of their mouths. They say, when they're talking about Vance, the state prosecutor, that only the Congress can investigate the president because the only limit on the president is the power of impeachment. When the Congress turns around and issues subpoenas, they say, oh no, these are investigative subpoenas, and that means they're acting like prosecutors, and they're not allowed to do that. So they're essentially trying to tame each side with the argument that the party in question, whether it's Vance or the Congress, is acting like a prosecutor on one hand or the Congress on the other. And that's obviously a bunch of malarkey. The Supreme Court has always said that Congress can issue subpoenas as long as they have a conceivable relationship to future legislation. I dare say that if it turns out that the President of the United States has been doing business with foreign powers on a regular basis, or that he cheated on his taxes, that I dare say there will be a legislative fix for that, to require disclosure of exactly these kinds of records in advance of an election. So to presuppose that just because they're investigating without a specific piece of legislation already on the boards, although in most of these cases there is, that's not an argument that makes sense to me. But, you know, and the ultimate risk here is the standing of the court. I think Justice Roberts in particular, and people like Justice Breyer and Justice Kagan, are very concerned about the institutional perception of the court. And that's why I think Roberts will work very, very hard to get a majority and probably a unanimous court, which, in other words, you know, a 9-0 decision in favor of certain principles, and try to give each side what they want. But a decision that basically enshrines principles that will apply without hesitation to the next president, but not this one, is to me not a victory for the people who are issuing the subpoenas. So we'll see how it turns out. I think this is an immensely consequential case in terms of the future behavior of the president.
Well, that's just it. I mean, what one president gets away with, subsequent presidents are going to try to get away with. And I guess my last question would be, moving to the highest prosecutor in the land, and that's Bill Barr.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about the assault on the rule of law from him? Because that's really what we're talking about, is the impunity of our highest officials to flout the law.
Well, you know, I have a good friend who was Bill Barr's chief of staff in his first stint as attorney general, which was under the first President Bush. And when Barr was nominated, I felt really good about it. And, you know, somebody asked me for public comment, and I said, hey, I think this is a good choice. Bill Barr has undergone a radical transformation in his personal life. And he is now a kind of Opus Dei Catholic who believes that Western civilization is collapsing because of the secularization and the assault on, you know, social norms that liberals in particular are conducting. And I guarantee you that from his point of view, things like, you know, abortion under certain circumstances and, you know, gay marriage and, you know, equality for transgendered people, I am certain he thinks that stuff like that is a fundamental assault on the values of Western civilization. That means that he is a passionate advocate for this administration, and he does not regard his position as being a neutral arbiter of the law so much as one that does the president's bidding. You know, Mr. Trump is reported to have asked, where is my Roy Cohen, referring to the lawyer who was his personal bulldog in private practice. Roy Cohen was ultimately replaced by Michael Cohen as the president's, you know, legal fixer. And Bill Barr has assumed that role now. And things like the way Barr misinterpreted the Mueller report at the time he released it, or, you know, withdrawing Michael Flynn's conviction on the eve of sentencing, are so far from the norms that the Justice Department has always exercised, or at least since Watergate attempted to exercise, that it's not clear to me that that balance is ever going to be restored. And the problem, if the Justice Department isn't doing that, if they're not making fair readings of the law and trying to uphold existing norms in the law, is that that's going to force the courts to do more and more. And, you know, they don't want to get involved in what are essentially political questions. You know, the issue in Flynn will turn out to be, can just any prosecutor come in and defy the judgment of the prosecutors before him? And that's a really loaded question. The answer might be yes, he or she can make that change. But I think there's a weighty answer on the other side, which says, no, wait a minute. You can't come in and consume the time and resources of the courts and say, we need to prosecute this person. He has broken the law, and put the court through the business of deciding that question and concluding, no, yes, that he has broken the law. And yes, we are going to sentence him. You can't come in after the courts have been used in this case for a year and a half and say, oh, wait a minute, we made a mistake in the first place. You can't do that, because if that principle obtains, then we're going to run riot over the criminal process as a whole. Every defendant is going to be lobbying like mad to get the Justice Department to come in and change its mind. And talking about the inequality between rich and poor, you know who's going to get the benefit of the doubt if the Justice Department is willing to intercede this way at the last minute. So I think this is a horrible practice, particularly when both the Mueller lawyers who first brought the case and then the members of the U.S. Attorney's Office in Washington, D.C., who took over the case, when they all concluded it was a warranted prosecution based on a solid legal footing. You can't allow this kind of last-minute change of heart without, you know, a better reason than the ones that Mr. Barr has offered.
And the defendant pled guilty twice. So, I mean, it's even more egregious.
Yes. But as I said, not only did Flynn say, I did this, but the judge had to make a determination after listening to Flynn say, I did this, that, yeah, that's actually a violation of the law. Now, that's a concluded matter in this case. There's a principle called law of the case. This issue has essentially already been decided when the judge accepted Flynn's guilty plea. And parties are not usually allowed to relitigate issues that have been decided in a case. And, you know, that ought to include the government. If there's been a mistake made, then the executive branch has the power of pardon. And, you know, Flynn can ask for and undoubtedly will get his pardon as soon as the election is over. But to have the Justice Department come in and say, well, these issues were decided, but we now have changed our mind, that is not something that I expect this judge to ultimately smile upon. But it's not a decided issue. My guess, if I can make a prediction, is that the judge will decide that the government cannot withdraw the case at this stage. And then they'll be off to the courts of appeals and the Supreme Court if necessary. And that's where the case will lie until Trump issues his pardon after the election.
What's your opinion on, once this kind of devastation of the rule of law happens in a society like ours, that it can come back? And if so, how?
I'm very, very fearful on that question. And the only real way it can come back is if the Congress steps in and legislates rules about the way the Department of Justice must behave. And even that is going to be subject to questions because, of course, the prosecution is fundamentally a function of the executive branch. And the argument will be, well, the Congress can't regulate that to the extent that they're trying to regulate it. But I think carefully drawn rules by the Congress may withstand scrutiny in the courts. But having somebody who comes in as the next attorney general and says, you know, I'm going to respect the rule of law. And by the way, you should contrast the behavior of Bill Barr with the head of the FBI, Christopher Wray, who has avoided injecting the FBI into all of these political messes. You know, it's hard because even if somebody like Chris Wray comes in and becomes attorney general next, the example will be out there of Barr's behavior. And there's no law that says you got to behave like Wray rather than Barr. And so until the Congress legislates, I really fear for the future of the Justice Department.
Well, Scott Turow, it has been such a pleasure to talk with you, really an honor. And I loved this book, your most recent book, The Last Trial. Thank you so much for talking with us here.
No, it was my pleasure, Francesca. Thanks, and thanks for letting the conversation roam into other subjects besides, you know, Sandy Stern and his last ride in the courtroom. So I appreciate it.
Novelist Scott Turow is the author of 10 novels and 3 works of nonfiction. Go to writersvoice.net for a peek at the explosive first page of The Last Trial. Now, something about a very important case decided in New York State in the last week. The New York presidential primary will go forward. That's news, because the state's Board of Election Commissioners, appointed by Governor Cuomo, had decided to cancel the primary. They claimed they were concerned about health concerns around the coronavirus. This in spite of the fact that down-ballot primaries were always still in effect and that the state is well capable of allowing the vote by mail. A lawsuit to reinstate the primary was filed by Andrew Yang and supporters and delegates for Senator Bernie Sanders. In early May, Judge Annalisa Torres ruled for the plaintiffs, saying the primary must go forward. The state appealed the decision, but this week, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals upheld Judge Torres's ruling. The primary shall proceed. But before that final decision, I spoke with previous guest on Writer's Voice, Poa Catherine Levy, about the case. She's one of the plaintiffs. And, full disclosure, I submitted testimony that was included in the plaintiff's amicus brief to the Second Circuit Court. Here's an excerpt of what Catherine Levy told me. I asked Catherine Levy to answer those who ask, why is this important, since both Bernie Sanders and Andrew Yang have suspended their campaigns?
There are two reasons. The most important issue in my mind has nothing to do with Bernie or Yang. It has to do with retroactively changing ballot access rules. So Bernie got 65,000 signatures. He qualified in every congressional district in New York. It's an extremely onerous thing to do. You have to collect thousands of signatures to do it. And as I said before, in the past, that has meant that you are absolutely assured of a place on the ballot. He was then certified. This was all in February. In April, the Board of Elections effectively changed the ballot rules, changed the election rules in the middle of an election cycle, and did something without any judicial review or any public discussion, which appears to be unconstitutional. So for me, the most important aspect of this is that we do not want to set the precedent, particularly going into the November election, that a state can retroactively change ballot access rules and election laws, and without any compelling reason, or even with a compelling reason, cancel an election. Please understand that if we do this in New York, there is nothing to stop states across the country from doing this same thing in November and using the New York instance as a precedent for it. That is my principal reason for being upset about this. But then there's something else that's important for people to understand. When delegates are elected to go to a convention, they're not just going to nominate a president, and they also nominate a vice president. They're going to serve on various essential committees. And the most important committees in terms of the Democratic Party in this election cycle are the Platform and the Rules Committee. The Platform Committee decides the policies on which the president is supposedly running, and it sets the direction for the party. But the much more important committee, in my view, is the Rules Committee. In 2016, after the election, the rules were significantly changed. So it did away with superdelegates having power on the first ballot, and it democratized the primary process in a number of ways. But those aren't permanent rules. They are going to be revisited this year. So the people who are the delegates for the convention are going to have a fundamentally important role in deciding the direction of primaries in the future for the Democratic Party. New York State has the second largest group of delegates in the country. If the delegate slate is entirely controlled by Andrew Cuomo and the leaders of the state Democratic Party, believe me, the input about the Rules Committee is going to be very different from what it would be if there are a substantial number of Bernie delegates on that delegation, as there would be. The other thing that's important, and on two counts, is that people have a constitutional right to state their preferences in elections, even elections they're not likely to win. When someone goes to vote for the Green Party, they have a pretty good understanding that the Green Party is not going to win the election, but they are stating a political preference. It's part of a First Amendment right. And New Yorkers, if this stands, will be the only group of people in the country who are not allowed to state their opinion about the presidential primary of what is probably the most consequential election of our lifetimes. And that, too, is a terrible precedent to set. And I just want to say one other thing. Two unelected Board of Elections commissioners have made the decision that the presidential primary is merely a beauty contest, not important. That should not be their decision to make. That is the decision of the voters to make. That's the decision of the constitutional process, not of two unelected bureaucrats in the Board of Elections.
The stakes are higher than New York's presidential primary, Levy says. They have national implications.
People keep saying to me, well, you know, what's the problem? You know, Bernie has endorsed Biden and everything. The problem is that we can't let executives or anybody in the state just strip candidates from the ballot at will and cancel elections. Because if Trump sees that happening here in a blue state, he's going to have a great precedent for doing it in November all over this country. It's incredibly dangerous, and people need to understand that.
That was Catherine Levy, a plaintiff in the lawsuit that restored the 2020 presidential primary to New York State. A Bernie delegate, she expects to go to the Democratic convention in August. The full interview aired on my home station, WPKN 89.5, serving Southern Connecticut and Eastern Long Island. You can hear it by going to writersvoice.net. And next week, we'll talk with Tyson Yunka Porta about his book, Sand Talk, How Indigenous Thinking Can Save the World. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.